At the beginning of the summer, one of my favorite authors, Anne Lamott, posted her recent top 20 reads. Being the book nerd and faithful fan that I am, I couldn't wait to read every book on her list. But being aware of my tendency to buy book after book and later feel guilty for not having made the time to actually read them, I decided to start small. I ordered 3 to start with and promised myself that I would not order another until I had read all 3. The first 2 were as good as I anticipated, and I was sure that I had saved the best for last. Not only was this book on the New York Times bestseller list, it also had won a Pulitzer Prize and at least 5 other highly acclaimed awards and prizes. I couldn't wait to jump in, and I knew it would be a book I couldn't put down. I took this prize with me to the beach so that I could read it for hours on end, certain that the author would be my new favorite. By the 2nd paragraph, I realized that this award-winning, highly acclaimed treasure was not at all what I had hoped it would be. I needed a Spanish to English dictionary before I finished the first page. By page 10, I also needed an English dictionary and an urban dictionary as well. Thank goodness for my phone being smart. Even then, it was slow going, but I was committed. I finished the book over the weekend, scratching my head and wondering what I had missed. I like to think that I'm at least as smart and have as much as average intelligence, and I really don't like feeling that I don't get it. But when it comes to this book and its great acclaim, I have to admit, I just don't get it. And I seem to be feeling that way with increasing regularity because the parable that Jesus tells his followers today leaves me scratching my head in puzzlement as well. The good news is that the parable has not won a Pulitzer Prize or any other awards that I'm aware of, and many more learned scholars than I seem to be scratching their heads as well about this one. And it is frequently the case when scholars are perplexed, they begin to split hairs in search of clear explanations. Did Jesus really say this in the manner that Luke has him say it, or did Luke mix and match Jesus' sayings out of context? Where does this parable actually begin and end? And what part of Luke's commentary is Luke's commentary on what Jesus is saying? And these sorts of queries are important in academia, but may not really have a lot of bearing on us today. What matters to us is what this is saying to me, to my life, and how am I called to live as one who claims to follow Christ? The attention of this parable is on the steward or manager. This is a person who has had the responsibility of care and handling the resources of someone else. In this instance, we're told that it is a rich man. The steward has been dishonest. He has wasted the rich man's possessions, and so the rich man calls him in and fires him. The newly unemployed steward, however, does not throw in the towel. He's seemingly continuing his pattern of deception, goes to those who owe the rich man money and gives them a discount. You owe 800 gallons of olive oil? Cut it down to 40. You owe 1,000 bushels of wheat? Just pay back 800 and we'll call it even. And sitting in our Monday morning quarterback seats, we can look at this scenario and find it flawed in all sorts of ways. He had no business doing that. He wasn't even the manager anymore. How dare he take this on himself, continuing to cheat his boss out of what was rightfully his? If that were my employee, and then, shock of shocks, the rich man finds out about what's been going on, and rather than put the manager in stocks, have him arrested and flogged, the rich man commends his shrewdness. And this is where we start scratching our heads in disbelief, and it gets worse. Luke has Jesus, it seems, tell us that we should behave similarly. To use use our wealth to gain friends, just as the steward did. And frankly, that just seems wrong. Why would Jesus tell us to buy friends? Jesus didn't tell us to use our wealth to buy friends. He said, use your wealth so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. What our translation terms dishonest wealth is the word mammon, which might be better thought of as worldly wealth. Use your worldly wealth to obtain friends so that you will be welcome into your eternal home. The one known as the dishonest steward was not rewarded for having cheated his employer, but he was forgiven because he showed favor on others and eased their burdens. He had been entrusted with much, and it had gotten the better of him. This steward had fallen short, had abused his master's wealth, and was now about to be thrown out. The rich man was at the point of giving up on him, but he acted shrewdly. The steward found a way that would relieve the burden of the people and give the appearance that his employer was the one who was good and generous. And for his quick thinking, his shrewdness in this weighty matter, he was rewarded. What sort of stewards are we? Are we dishonest stewards? Have we been entrusted with much? We've been entrusted with the kingdom and all that is in it, with God's bounty. How have we managed what God has given us? Our time, our talents, our wealth. Last week I said that money doesn't matter to Jesus, and that is true only in part. What we do with our wealth, whether we use it for good or for ill, matters very much. Each of us is a steward. And this quirky, difficult parable is aimed right at us. Perhaps we've been dishonest in our dealings with God. Perhaps we've tried to fix the books, or hide our talents, or store up the treasures entrusted to us. The really good news is that even the dishonest steward is forgiven. Even those of us who have squandered our wealth can return to the arms of a loving Father. The slate can be made clean, the past erased. The dishonest steward can be affirmed as a shrewd manager. In God's economy, none is without hope, not one of us. All we need to do is turn around, return to God. Amen.